Hey team, this is Captain Emily Seaton from 20th Air Force Public Affairs, and you're listening to 2420, the podcast that delivers 20th Air Force information in about 20 minutes. We know there are a lot of questions surrounding the Missile Community Cancer Study, so our hope is that this series can help answer those questions and build a better understanding of the situation. In this first episode, Major General Mike Lutton and Colonel Tori Woodard from Air Force School of Aerospace Medicine discuss the design of the study, what the process looks like, what they're testing for, and what exactly are PCBs. There's a lot of information in this episode, so let's dive in.
Hello, team. I'm Major General Mike Lutton, Commander 20th Air Force. As many are aware, earlier this year, General Bussier, the commander of Air Force Global Strike Command, approved a comprehensive study designed by the U.S. Air Force School of Aerospace Medicine to conduct a formal assessment that addresses specific cancer concerns raised by missile community members across related career fields and examines the possibility of clusters of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma at intercontinental ballistic missile bases. Today I am joined by Colonel Tori Woodard, the commander of U.S. Air Force School of Aerospace Medicine. Colonel Woodard is here to give insight into details about the study. I appreciate your time. I thought it would be good for the audience to understand what USAF-SAMS is. What that organization is, who constitutes that organization, and what does your team bring to the fight?
Yes, sir. Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the opportunity. So USAF-SAM, or the School of Aerospace Medicine, you know, really our mission is research, education, and consultation. We're a schoolhouse set up like a small academic institution. We've got a dean, academic affairs, and we are the primary schoolhouse for bioenvironmental engineering, public health, aerospace medicine, including all flight surgeons, all flight nurses, all aeromedical evacuation teams. And we do also aerospace physiology training here at USAF-SAM, the initial officer and enlisted as well, as part of AETC support. But we're really a schoolhouse, but we're more than that because we have the synergistic ability in that we have the world consultants and some specialty labs here. So those laboratory personnel are also our instructors. They're also our consultants. So when you hear about the epidemiologic consult service that is doing this study from within our public health department, that's a team of experts, of national experts that commonly works with CDC and other organizations to do things like flu and track diseases. And so we have expertise in these things. Also, within USAF-SAM is the Epi Lab, which really people have heard about through the COVID pandemic, because at some one point in time, we were doing a large majority and a large number of the COVID testing and sequencing for the DoD, really. So it's really, you know, primarily a schoolhouse, but also the consultant cell.
And from your discussion, it sounds like it has global reach, right? You can reach out to a number of constituents in the medical or bioenvironmental community to support your effort.
That's correct. We are sort of the reach back consultant cell for, you know, worldwide for any bases. We also work with DHA or DOD. We also work with other external agencies like the CDC. We also, as part of our training and other parts of aerospace medicine and operational medicine, we work with NASA, we work with the FAA. So we work with a lot of external partners, as well as academic institutions. Some people know that we also control the C-STARS sites like Baltimore Shock Trauma and other sites where we do trauma training around the U.S. where we embed our providers with civilian entities to try and get the ultimate training so we're ready to do the mission wherever that is.
And USAF-SAMS is central to the cancer study, correct?
Yes, sir. So we are the primary go-to. Our customer right now is Air Force Global Strike Command, but we have many partners and stakeholders in that, including 20th Air Force, including the SG's office, DHA or Defense Health Agency, but really we are the primary. And there's really just two main efforts that we're working on, the epidemiologic study to try and find out what's the real answer to what are the cancer rates out there in the missileers and the associated career fields and that work with them. And then also the other effort is this large environmental and occupational hazard sampling.
Can you talk the audience through how you design a study like that? And what is the real expertise that's required to design a study that's both comprehensive and credible?
The first thing that we do is go through and figure out, what do we know? What's the current state of the science that we have now? So when we initially got these concerns that were brought up earlier in this year, we started to look at, what are the rates? What do we know? What is the information that we have? And so that team would include public health experts, it include bioenvironmental, it would include researchers, epidemiologists, and then we work and we can pull data from multiple sources. So once we figure out what is the extent of the science that we know now and what gaps do we need to fill, and then we would move out on that to try and determine, again, it sort of depends if you're asking about the epidemiologic study or the environmental study, but that's more the epidemiologic. Environmental would be similar. What's the state of the science? What do we know? What are the risks or the hazards that we know about? And then we would set up a site visit or a shop visit like we might normally do at any other occupational shop, find out and take a look around and say, okay, what are the hazards and potential, and what are some unknowns, and how do we test and look at that to fill gaps in our knowledge?
When you're looking at the current cancer study, and there were two sites at Malmstrom that had polychlorinated biphenyl numbers that were above the code of federal regulation, can you briefly discuss what a polychlorinated biphenyl is for the audience? And then also kind of give the audience an understanding of why an air sample could come back negative. They're not present in the air, but they could come back present on the surface.
Sure. Yeah. Polychlorinated biphenyls, or PCBs, much easier to say it that way, are a compound that have produced many years ago, early in the century, used in many industrial and occupational settings because of their uniqueness and because of their ability to absorb heat. So they were used in many electronic components, such as fluorescent lighting and a lot of radios and capacitors and things that we would use in a military setting. So they were commonly used, especially in the probably 50s, 60s, 70s, in a lot of our electronic equipment. They were banned in the US in the 1970s, in the late 1970s, from production and use, and we've slowly been trying to remove them, but they are persistent. They commonly are there as kind of an oily substance with kind of a light color, maybe a brownish or light yellow color, and they're very persistent in the environment. And they get in and they stay around a while. And so they are sort of ubiquitous in the environment, as it were. They get into lakes and streams and rivers, and they're in our food. To a certain degree, there are limits within the FDA and other regulations of what can be in food products and food, like food wrappers and things like that. The most common cause where people will be exposed to PCBs is actually in the food chain, similar to mercury, how it gets absorbed into fish. So it gets into the lakes or rivers, and then the fish feed on the bottom, the elements on the bottom of the lakes, and then it gets absorbed in those fish, and then we eat the fish. So the most common way that the general public will be exposed would be through their diet, and usually eating fish and things like that. And commonly, some states or territories will have warnings on eating fish in certain lakes if there's a high level in there. The question, you know, our exposure in the miscellaneous community is, where are they coming from? Usually it's from a leak in an older component, as they either get hot or they leak and then it gets on the surface. These compounds, the one we use in our electronics, are very thick and very heavy, so meaning that they don't volatilize or become airborne easily. So they don't evaporate quickly and become airborne. They stay on the surface because of this thick, oily substance. So that is why we would have a negative air test, which is what we want. And that is often more concerning to us as occupational medicine world, is if they're airborne PCBs, because they will get ingested and absorbed. But if they're on the surface, we may see them from old leaks, and then someone touches it unknowingly and then spreads it to a different area. And so that's how we believe they're in our work centers there. And many of our components in those racks of equipment had known PCB-containing components in the past.
Thank you. And that is a very comprehensive explanation and greatly appreciated. So we talk about the PCB findings and the swipes, but the air sampling was fairly extensive. Can you speak to the air sampling, the number of samples, the duration that the air was sampled for?
Yes. So we did two air samples, and I'll speak specifically at Malmstrom. So because Malmstrom, the construction, as we know, is a little bit different than the other sites. So we did one air sample down within the LCC and then one air sample within the topside, the support building. Those air samples are really run on an 8-hour. We have a pump that just basically sucks air, and it sucks the air and runs it across a little filter medium. And then we take that out and then we send that out to be analyzed. So we use an 8-hour air sample where the team goes down and checks every once in a while on that and runs it. So a pretty comprehensive time period for that.
And you talk about comprehensive time period, but the sampling was also comprehensive in that each one of the launch control centers and missile alert facilities was sampled.
That's correct. So a total of the 15 MAFs and LCCs, they each had the two samples done. So one in the LCC and one in the topside. So 30 air samples were taken total, along with 300 swipe samples for the surface contaminant. So the 20 swipes were taken across the LCCs for the PCB swipe samples. We did that at areas of known previous installation of a PCB containing component, as well as common touch areas within the LCC to look for any cross-contamination across where our workers may be commonly accessing items or touching items.
Okay, excellent. And then as you look at the study, there's clearly different items that are being sampled for, which have different timelines to get back analysis on. Can you give the audience a general perspective on the number of sensors? Because I know radon was brought up, but the radon sensor is downstairs and topside at the missile alert facilities and downstairs at the launch control center. But my understanding is that's like almost a 60 to 90 day sampling period. So can you talk about the different sensors and the durations that those sensors are going to be out there?
And first I want to say, sir, thank you for your quick action to allow us the clearance to take some of these new equipment that previously hadn't been approved to take down in those work centers so we could do this. So when we went out to do the sampling visit, it is a large range of air, soil, water sampling, as well as radon. So specifically the radon, we leave a meter there for a sensor there for 90 days. We come back and pick it up and then send it off for analysis. So that 90 days in most of ours started in, I believe, mid to early June. So we'll be coming up on those, and we will repeat that radon sampling 3 times this year to get a kind of a cross look at environmental seasonal changes. But the air, soil, water, other sampling, some was done real time, meaning we can test temperature and humidity real time and record those. Other ones will have to be sent off. We sent usually 1 to 2 large coolers per MAF, got mailed out to other external national and DOD labs to be analyzed. So it was about 2,000 samples total per base to be sent out. And some of those will take a couple weeks, like the PCB samples, and some will take 4 to 6 weeks for those results to come back. And then what we do when they come back, we'll call it a spreadsheet with data from the external lab, and then we have to cross-reference that with our data, our known samples and our location in our logbooks of where that was. And so we have a QA process here at USAF-SAM, and then we put those in a format like you saw in the results we released this week. We put that in a format that's digestible to the external stakeholders. So it's quite an extensive process, but it takes time. Our intent is to publish immediate results, like in this case, as necessary, but otherwise we'll publish one large summary per base when all the data is available per phase. So we'll have 3 reports coming out this fall for the 3 bases. We'll have 3 reports coming out this winter and 3 reports coming out next spring.
Can you talk to the audience about why you're doing that 3-phase approach and that 3-phase look for analysis?
We want to look for seasonal variations in some of the hazards there. We know that radon, for instance, can fluctuate based on the groundwater and the pressure that groundwater puts on the gases in the ground. We also know that some of the occupational and environmental and industrial hazards can fluctuate in the seasons. Many of our MAFs and LFs are located next to fields for which we don't control what the farmers or the local industry does. We know there's aerial spraying of pesticides in some of the sites where our bases are located. So we want to take a look at some of those seasonal variations. And we understand that sometimes seasonal variations also deal with weather and the winds and, you know, the door in your house you may keep open more often, which decreases airflow in the summer, right? But in the winter, when everything's closed up, it decreases airflow at times. And so we want to assess some of these variations to make sure we're getting a great picture of the occupational environmental hazards. Once that's all done, what we intend to do is help the bases develop a long-term environmental sampling plan. You know, what do they need to do for a once a year visit, or whether it's once a year or once every 6 months, this will help us develop a long-term plan for how we monitor these sites in the future.
You know, I saw on a note that we exchanged this morning, you're heading off to Vandenberg Space Force Base towards the end of September. Can you talk to the purpose of that visit and maybe some of the organizations your team is going to meet with out there?
As we have gone through this process, we're continuing to adjust fire as needed. And one of the concerns that was brought up is that Vandenberg is a training location for which all missileers pass through. And a lot of activities have happened there out in the past, and a lot of trainers are there. And so we were requested to come out and take a look at that and make sure that there's nothing that we're missing that might benefit our team going out there. So we'll do an initial site visit out there, hopefully within the next month or so. And then that we'll come back to USAF SAM, and we'll sit down with our team and develop a plan for if there's any sampling or what we need to do next out there, just like we did at the other bases. But because that was a common site where people pass through, I think it's something that we should look at, make sure that we, again, fill gaps in our knowledge and make sure that we're assessing this properly.
When you look at this study and you look at the 12 to 18 month timeframe, I think you indicated, does that also include a peer review of the data that your team has developed and analyzed and concluded on to further enforce the credibility of the findings?
Yes. So even when we developed the initial epidemiologic study, we brought in partners from the VA and the National Cancer Institute to review what we were doing to make sure that we had a good external look at this and make sure we had the right site picture. And then as we continue to get ready to publish those and push out our results, we will have peer review by civilian and academic and other institutions to make sure that we've done our due diligence, we understand the results are in a manner that is being effectively communicated, and that it has appropriate review from a secondary source to make sure that there's no unintended Air Force bias in it.
For the two sites at Malmstrom that were above the federal regulation limit, can you talk to the remediation process and how we're actually going to have scientific confidence that the remediation process that we execute is effective?
We'll work with the Global Strike offices. So within the maintenance community that does some of that, A4, A5, along with SG, to come up with a comprehensive plan to do that. A remediation for a surface like that usually involves wiping down with really a turpentine or other type substance to try and absorb some of that and dilute some of that. So there's a whole cleanup procedure for which we have documentation for that. So the team will be brought in to do that. And then the intent would be to do some sampling on the tail end of that to make sure that we're getting that cleaned up to the level that it needs to be.
Can you talk about what's after the study? So we do the three seasons, we publish three consecutive reports, and then what does it look like from your perspective? What does it look like when this initial study concludes?
I think one of the things is we will bring the two studies together to provide synergy in our knowledge base of what we have going on. So the epidemiologic study, we didn't really touch on what that's going to look like. So I'll kind of touch on that now. What we intend to do is study not only the non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, which was one of the initial concerns brought up in missileers, but 13 other cancers to try and determine what are the cancer rates in our missileers and also our associated other career fields. Because we know as we go out there occupationally, we have maintenance folks, we have security forces, we have the MAFMs, cooks, we have other people that are exposed to some of these in the occupational environment. So we're looking at really two groups, the Missileers and the other associated career fields. And what we will do is look at what are the top cancers that we see from our DoD data within those groups. And then we will compare that against other DoD and national and VA rates to try and determine what is the cancer rates out there. Because what we want to know is what is the actual rate and is it above what we would expect it to be in a normal civilian or other populations. And that will guide us. And then if we have the environmental hazard assessment, we can merge those together and say, okay, we have these, you know, potentially increased cancer rates, whether it's non-Hodgkin's or thyroid cancers or others that we're looking at. But we really have to have that good data to be able to pull those together to be able to make an accurate assessment. And then that will help us drive future actions. And those actions may include discussing with the VA about what we found so that people can get appropriate compensation in the future if this is determined to be an elevated risk, and also to help inform our future occupational, environmental, and other hazard assessment. And I think also what we're hoping is this is something that we could push forward as we develop Sentinel, so that we can use this data to help us assure that the new weapon system that comes online is appropriately mitigated.
I appreciate that, especially the part about what we can do right now, and then how this is going to inform future operations and activity as we modernize our force and defend the nation. I know everyone in Global Strike Command appreciates your team's hard work and the leadership and the technical expertise required to execute this study. Thanks so much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of 2420. While General Lutton and Colonel Woodard spoke about a lot, we know they did not answer all of your questions. We have more episodes coming your way, focusing more on the personal medical side. But in the meantime, a great resource to check out is the Missile Community Cancer Study website, which is at www.airforcemedicine.af.mil/resources/missile-community-cancer-study, or you can just simply Google Missile Community Cancer Study. This website has the most up-to-date information about the cancer study, as well as places to ask questions and find answers. I encourage everyone, go check it out. See you next time.